Hello, and welcome to the podcast of Northwestern University Law Review Online. My name is William Gohl, Senior Online Editor for the Law Review. Northwestern Law Review publishes articles and essays on a broad range of topics in the law. This podcast series focuses on our recently published content and also explores new and relevant topics in the law. This and all other podcasts in the series are available on the Law Review's brand new website, www.northwesternlawreview.org. Today's episode features the recently published essay by Professor Michael Carrier, How Not to Apply Activists. In the essay, Professor Carrier explores two recent district court decisions that could frustrate the Supreme Court's recent directive to apply antitrust law to exclusion payment patent settlements. These patent settlements occur when a generic drug producer challenges the validity of brand name producers' patents. Rather than fight out the validity of the patent in court, the brand name drug companies pay the generic producer to drop its suit and delay entering the market. The court's high-profile activist decision set broad guidelines for lower courts on how to assess these settlements for antitrust violations. Carefully surveying these two recent district court decisions, Professor Carrier argues that the two courts misunderstood the Supreme Court's guidance and improperly favored settlements at the expense of meaningful antitrust scrutiny. Carrier concludes that consumers will end up paying the price if other courts do not step in to correctly apply activists. Professor Carrier is a distinguished professor of law at Rutgers Law School, Camden, where his teaching and research centers on antitrust, copyright, patent, and intellectual property law. On the topic of pharmaceutical antitrust law, he has written 15 articles, testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee's Antitrust Subcommittee, and submitted amicus briefs on behalf of hundreds of professors and antitrust or consumer organizations in courts throughout the country. Our online executive editor, Brian O'Connell, recently spoke with Professor Carrier to discuss his essay.
Professor Carrier, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Could you start by briefly describing what exclusion payment patent settlements are and why they present a concern?
With an exclusion payment settlement, you have a brand name drug company paying a generic to delay entering the market. So the brand company files a patent lawsuit saying that the generic infringes, and the parties settle. And the settlement is not the problem. The problem is that the brand makes a payment to the generic for extra delayed entry, and that is what the problem is.
Have there been exclusion payments for any high-profile drugs that our listeners might be familiar with?
Many. So Cipro was an antibiotic, tamoxifen, the breast cancer drug, Provigil, a sleep disorder drug, Nexium, the heartburn drug, Lamictal, an epilepsy drug, Loestrin, the contraceptive. There are many high-profile drugs. And the reason is that when generics enter the market, the price falls dramatically. So you might imagine that the brand name drug companies have extra interest in paying the generic to delay entering the market, because each day of delayed generic entry is millions of dollars in the brand firm's pocket.
What motivated the Supreme Court and activists to apply antitrust scrutiny to exclusion payments?
The Supreme Court recognized that this sort of behavior could violate the antitrust law. For most of the decade before the Supreme Court's decision, courts had followed what was known as the scope of the patent test. And as applied by those courts, basically the scope of the patent test found that all of these settlements were fine because they allowed entry before the nominal end of the patent term, and they basically assumed that the patent was valid and infringed. The Supreme Court, in the activist decision, found that that tilted the balance too far in favor of the patent laws, and therefore that there was a role for antitrust law to play. And so the court found that when one company pays another not to enter the market, that presents severe harm and could violate the antitrust law.
Do you think the decision in activists was a step in the right direction? And if so, why?
I do. I think that this is very concerning behavior. Federal Trade Commission found that these settlements cost consumers more than $3 billion a year. And even if it is less than that amount, for each patient that cannot take a generic drug because it is too expensive, that's a real harm. That is a harm where a patient is not taking medicine that they need. They're splitting pills in half. And so this is a real concern, and antitrust scrutiny is completely appropriate for this sort of behavior. Again, one company paying another not to enter the market is very concerning.
The activist court discussed five considerations to be used in analyzing exclusion payments. The five considerations are the anti-competitive effect of the exclusion payment settlement, 2, the lack of justification for the settlement, 3, the market power of the parties to the settlement, 4, the feasibility of judicial analysis, and finally, the ability of the parties to settle without an exclusion payment. What role did the court envision for these five considerations?
The court used these five considerations to show that one policy that previous courts had been relying on was not dispositive. Those courts, for most of the decade before the activist decision, had really focused on this policy in favor of settlement. Generally, settlement is a good thing. It helps the parties, it helps the courts. And so a lot of these courts said that settlement was a good thing. So therefore, these settlements by which the brand paid the generic to delay entering the market would be fine. And what the Supreme Court did in an incredibly important decision was find that these five considerations showed that there's more to consider than just the policy in favor of settlement. Yes, settlement generally is a good thing, but no, it doesn't provide the only analysis here. And so at the end of the day, the court used these five considerations to make clear that the Federal Trade Commission, the plaintiff in the case, should be allowed to prove its case.
In your essay, you take a very close look at two post-activist district court decisions, In re Loestrin and In re Lamictal. Both suits involved exclusion payment patent settlements, and both resulted in the district court ruling that the settlements did not violate antitrust law. Can you briefly summarize the problems you see in the two decisions?
Sure. The problem is that those two courts used the five considerations that the Supreme Court had used for a very different purpose. The Supreme Court used these five considerations to show that the policy in favor of settlement was not dispositive, that there would in fact be antitrust scrutiny of these concerning settlements, and the courts used these factors to circumvent the Supreme Court's ruling. The Lamictal case made all sorts of findings that basically assumed the defendant's state of affairs, that assumed that whatever the defendant would offer as an argument should be true. And the Loestrin decision forced the plaintiffs to satisfy hurdles that were never envisioned in the activist case. So the Loestrin said basically, plaintiffs, you have to show a precise payment. You have to show exactly what it is. In activist, the court just said, we're looking for a payment for delayed generic entry. You don't have to show an exact amount, and that was the problem with the Loestrin decision.
You argue that the two district courts failed to properly assess the five activist factors. We'd like to walk you through each and have you tell us if and how the district courts misconstrued these considerations. The first is the anti-competitive effects of the exclusion payment settlement. How did the Lamictal court underestimate the harm from the settlement?
So the Lamictal court was dealing with a promise that the brand made to the generic by which the brand pledged not to introduce its own generic. It's called an authorized generic. And the question is, did that count as a payment? And so under the Hatch-Waxman Act, which is the relevant regulatory regime for the pharmaceutical industry, the first generic to challenge the brand firm's patent, claiming that it is invalid or not infringed, it's 180 days on the market all to itself. That period is extremely valuable to the generic. It could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars, according to the Supreme Court. But if that generic has to share the 180-day period with a brand's version, again called the authorized generic, then all of a sudden that period is a lot less valuable, because when the authorized generic enters the market during that 180-day period, the price falls quite a bit, market share from the true generic is taken away. And so the question is this valuable when the brand makes a no authorized generic pledge to the true generic? This is extremely valuable to the generic, but the problem with the Lamictal decision is that the court failed to understand the economics of the pharmaceutical industry. The Lamictal court said it's just a brief 6 months, there is no anti-competitive harm, just sounds like it's not that long a time. But even within the 6 months, even within the 180 days, the generic gets most of its profits. Again, the Supreme Court said this was worth millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. And so when Lamictal said, oh, there's nothing to worry about here, that didn't really wrestle with the pharmaceutical industry and the economics in the industry.
The second activist consideration focuses on the party's justifications. What did the Loestrin and Lamictal court do here?
So the Lamictal court basically said on this factor that payment was okay because it allowed the brand firm to remove uncertainty. And there's always the chance that when you have a settlement that that will remove uncertainty, because you're basically getting rid of the risk that a court would find that the patent is invalid or not infringed. The problem, however, is that the Supreme Court directly addressed this argument. And the Supreme Court said that if you eliminate risk that the patent is invalid or not infringed, that is anti-competitive. And the reason is that it prevents the risk of competition. It prevents the chance for a court to find this patent to be invalid or not infringed, which leads to early generic entry and the lowering of price for consumers. And so the problem is that Lamictal focused on this justification that the Supreme Court took away. In terms of the Loestrin decision, the court there said the plaintiff had to show a precise value of the settlement payment, and the activist decision never required such a high threshold. The court in activist made clear that the defendant was the party that had the burden of proof on justifications. And there's also the question as to how the plaintiff would ever show an exact value when they're filing a complaint, and it is the defendant that has access to all this evidence, like business reasons for the settlement. And so in short, with Lamictal focusing on risk, which the Supreme Court removed as a defense, and Loestrin setting the bar very high with a precise value, we see the problems with the application of the second factor.
The third activist factor is market power. How did the Loestrin court apply this?
So when the Supreme Court looked at this issue, it said that sometimes the size of a payment is so large that it can show market power. At times, it's difficult to show market power. You have to define a market. You have to figure out market share. But the Supreme Court said some payments are so large that, in essence, they themselves show market power. And so that really was a finding that helped the plaintiffs. When you look at what the Loestrin court did, it flipped that around 180 degrees. The Loestrin court said, when you look at the size of the payment, that leads to the question, is there market power that could lead to harm? And that leads to the conclusion that the payment must be in cash, because only cash payments can be valued. If it's a non-cash payment, like that no authorized generic promise we talked about before, then that doesn't count. And so the Loestrin court took a factor that was designed to help plaintiffs in showing them another way that they could prove market power and flipping it around to say only cash payments count. Finally, if you look at the evidence in the case, the brand had priced their drug 60% above the marginal cost of production, and so there were facts that supported market power, but at least as Loestrin applied this factor, it got it 180 degrees completely backwards.
The fourth activist factor is feasibility of judicial analysis. Were there any problems with the Lamictal court's reasoning on this issue?
Yes. In Actavis, the Supreme Court said that a reverse payment can serve as a surrogate for patent weakness. And so the difficulty here is that sometimes it's difficult to figure out whether or not the patent is valid or infringed in the middle of an antitrust trial. So in a case before the Supreme Court ruled, the 11th Circuit said this is a turducken approach, turkey inside duck inside chicken, because it's really complicated to figure out within an antitrust case what the patent merits would be. And so in Actavis, the Supreme Court said when we look at the payment itself, take a look at a really large payment, that tells you that the brand firm is really worried that maybe its patent is not valid, and that's why it's willing to pay the generic a lot of money to make sure that this never gets to court. When the Lamictal court looked at this, however, it flipped it around and focused on the party's intent. The Lamictal court concluded that the settlement did not suggest an intent to maintain high prices. So it's really unclear how the Lamictal court knows what the parties intended, other than a blanket sentence that asserts so, because there's no evidence really that the court focused on that. And that really wasn't the point of the fourth consideration. The fourth consideration, again, was to show that a reverse payment can serve as a surrogate for patent weakness. It was not designed to give the parties a chance to focus on intent to show what all their good intent was. That had nothing to do with the activist decision.
The fifth and final activist factor is the ability of the parties to settle without an exclusion payment. Were there concerns with the Loestrin and Lamictal court's applications of this factor?
Yes, the Lamictal court focused on parties' ability to settle and said that parties should be able to settle without worrying about antitrust scrutiny. In contrast, the Supreme Court said that you don't need payment to settle, that most settlements today do not involve payment. They just involve a generic entry date that's based on the strength of the patent, where the brand firm wants entry as late as possible, the generic wants entry as early as possible, and the two sides agree on the date of entry. And that's fine, and that's how most cases today are settled. The Supreme Court said you don't need payment to settle, and that goes against what Lamictal held. In terms of the Loestrin decision, the court said we need to assess payment in light of the reasons given. Again, there shouldn't be a focus on intent here, nor should there be an exact value that is required. Loestrin said the plaintiff has to show the exact value, compare it to the monopoly profits. But again, that's not something under activists that the plaintiff needs to do.
Most generally, what was the greatest concern with the district court's use of the five factors?
The Supreme Court in activists used these five factors to rebut this belief among the lower courts before the decision that the policy in favor of settlement was enough so that these agreements basically were immunized. In contrast, these two decisions twisted the five factors that were designed to allow antitrust scrutiny to proceed and flipped them on their head to say that antitrust scrutiny was not allowed. In addition, the Lamictal court basically assumed that what defendants were arguing was true, and the Loestrin court set high bars that were nowhere in the Supreme Court's opinion.
You mentioned that, besides the five factors, the Loestrin and Lamictal courts ignored other holdings in activists. For example, that courts shouldn't let public policy favoring settlements override antitrust law, and that courts shouldn't start from the presumption that exclusion payments are pro-competitive, thereby putting an added burden of persuasion on parties challenging the settlement. It seems unusual for two separate courts to issue decisions so contrary to the Supreme Court. Do you believe this to be a result of the court not providing clear enough guidance, or is there something else at play here?
These are complex cases. They arise at the intersection of patent law, antitrust law, and the Hatch-Waxman Act. And they're so complicated that courts sometimes look for shortcuts. And that's why we had a version of the scope of the patent test for most of the decade before the Supreme Court's decision that basically said all of these agreements were automatically fined. These two courts did not accept guidance from the Supreme Court. Sure, the court could have been more clear on certain issues that we haven't talked about in this interview, but at least as far as the simple issues that were in front of the Lamictal and Western courts, the courts basically just ignored the guidance that the Supreme Court offered. So, for example, when the Supreme Court said that 180-day period was extremely valuable, worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the generic, then the Lamictal court really should not have said 6 months, that's just a small period of time, no anti-competitive harm here. That's really difficult to square with the Supreme Court's finding that goes in exactly the opposite direction. The Lowestern court struggled and said, I don't know exactly what to do. At the end of the day, though, it followed Lamictal, and it realized that the drug companies could evade the decision pretty easily. But again, the Lowestern court, in following Lamictal, failed to follow the Supreme Court sufficiently. The court gave clear guidance on a lot of the issues that Lamictal and Lowestern struggled with.
Why are these two decisions potentially so important?
These decisions are so important just to make sure that antitrust still has a role to play here. The Supreme Court was clear that it is not just patent law that is relevant in looking at these agreements, that antitrust law has a crucial role to play as well, that competition is essential to the pharmaceutical marketplace today. And if these court decisions stand and they're upheld on appeal, then there basically is no role left for antitrust law in this area. Form will trump substance. The courts will say that only cash is concerning, even though today you don't see cash settlements anymore. The payment is all hidden in different places. So, for example, the authorized generic promise is worth hundreds of millions of dollars in many cases to the generic. And so if we say that it is only cash that applies and nothing else counts, then that is a roadmap to evade antitrust scrutiny and raise prices for consumers.
Do you believe that we'll continue to see applications of the intersection of patent and antitrust law beyond exclusion payments? If so, should these be dealt with by the courts or should Congress step in?
The intersection of patent and antitrust law is very hot today and spills over into numerous areas. The patent system gives you a right to exclude. The antitrust laws could punish that exclusion. There are many industries in which there is a lot at stake, and that's why this issue is so hot. So just to pick one example, patent assertion entities that are sometimes called patent trolls have been the subject of attention across all branches of government, from President Obama to the Patent and Trademark Office to the Federal Trade Commission and state attorneys general, all trying to weigh in on this. And then also we have Congress and the courts. Congress is considering the Innovation Act. It passed the House of Representatives 325-91 in December of 2013, but didn't get past the Senate. It was reintroduced again. And so that could address these patent assertion entities, and there are a whole bunch of provisions in there. Some are more controversial than others. So certainly Congress can play a role here, and the courts can play a role as well. The Supreme Court over the last couple of years has decided several cases that are very important on these lines. And so, for example, you look at the patentable subject matter decisions. In one case last year, the Alice case, the Supreme Court said that it's going to be really hard to get a software patent. It didn't speak in those words, but that was the effect of the decision. And we've seen since the Alice case that the number of software patents has gone down, the number of applications. Courts are invalidating these patents more. And so, in short, there is a role for both Congress and the courts, not to mention other government agencies, to play in this area.
Professor Carrier, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Brian O'Connell interviewing Professor Michael Carrier. To read more about the intersection of patent settlements and antitrust law, check out our website, www.northwesternlawreview.org. Also, be sure to get the latest on Northwestern Law Review's publications by following us on Twitter and liking us on Facebook. This concludes our podcast. Thank you for listening. Until next time.